You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Stay tuned for Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Boys Who Said No, a documentary film screening on Saturday, September 14th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House in Portland. During the Vietnam War, draft resistors openly refused military service to draw others to oppose the war. The Boys Who Said No is a documentary film featuring interviews with resistors and historians. Individuals featured include folk singer and activist Joan Baez, resistance leader David Harris, Cleveland Sellers of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, and Muhammad Ali. Again, that's The Boys Who Said No, screening Saturday, September 14th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House, 4312 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
And welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey, Rachel.
Hey.
We are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Both of us are public school teachers, and we host every second Monday of the month where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today on the phone is Yvette Falarca. Hello, Yvette.
Hi.
Hey, good to hear your voice again.
Thank you. You too.
So let's get right into telling us a little bit about your background and experience as an educator.
Sure. I teach in Berkeley Unified School District. I'm a public school teacher at a middle school. I've been teaching in Berkeley about 12, 13 years. And then before then, I taught at San Lorenzo and then in Oakland as a substitute teacher.
Gotcha. So you've been at it for a little while.
I have, over 20 years, actually.
And what is it that you're teaching, or what subject area?
So I teach middle school, 8th grade humanities, so that's English and history. And then I also teach English language development to ELL students who are intermediate and advanced level.
Okay. Yeah, great. And what inspired you to become a teacher?
You know, I never thought I'd become a teacher ever, but I was part of the Oakland teacher strike way back in 1996. And I was part of that strike not as a teacher but as a community organizer, and I organized students with BAM, and we organized high school students to build their own union called the Student Power Union that was really active and that went out on strike even before the teachers did. They had their own demands. They intervened during the strike, and they helped that strike win. And so that really inspired me to continue and to see the power and also the efficacy in being a public school teacher and active in my union.
Okay, interesting. And what about now as a teacher? What is it that you really enjoy most about that?
I really enjoy having the students being so honest and demanding real answers, and the possibility to develop new leaders that our world really, really needs, because there's clearly a crisis, and they are clearer and more courageous than a lot of adults. And
yes.
So they keep me accountable, and they keep the rest of us accountable and honest and hopeful, too.
This is Rachel here. How involved are you with your local and or your state union?
I'm a site rep at my school, and so in Berkeley what that means is that I'm then also a member of the executive board of the Berkeley Federation of Teachers. So I've been an executive board member now for several years, on and off, and So we meet regularly, and we're in the middle of a contract negotiation fight right now. I'm one of the people who really strongly believes that we need to go on strike and that we've got to spread the teacher strike wave, especially in the West Coast and especially in California, because our state is flush. It's like obscenely overwhelmed with money, right, and resources. But that is being kept from our students and from teachers. And so I'm hoping, and a number of people in my school and throughout the district are also ready to strike, but I'm hoping that we can mobilize and make sure that that actually happens and overcome the reticence of our union leadership that is either too nice, to put it nicely, or just too prepared to be like a company union and try to make things work for the administration rather than fight the way that we need to fight for our members and for our students.
Interesting. Do you feel like you have support on the state level for this movement to strike, this momentum?
Yeah, there's a lot, definitely. You know, I think more so than ever before. The teachers in Los Angeles went on strike earlier this year. That was just a huge, I mean, that was just hugely inspiring to everybody. And that then that inspired the teachers in Oakland to strike. And our caucus, which is called the Eon BAM Caucus, Equal Opportunity Now by Any Means Necessary Caucus, was very active in intervening and leading the strike in Oakland and fought for the strike to stay and continue even longer, because the tentative agreement that the union leadership came up with was way too weak and did not reflect the real strength of the strike. And so even though the strike didn't win as much as it could have, it still was still such a positive model for the rest of us. And I know that that's been then an inspiration between LA and Oakland for a lot of people throughout California who are talking strike, who are going out on strike. We've had two other school districts, even though they're relatively smaller than LA and Oakland. It's just the fact that they've gone on strike since those two has been really, really important. There's now a threat of another strike in one of the school districts in Northern California. And, you know, I know that there's lots of teachers who recognize that this is the best time ever for us to fight and to strike. We've got a state flush with money. We've got a Democratic Party supermajority that keeps claiming that they're for public education and gets tons of money from teachers, you know, unions and from our dues. So it's time for them to put their money where their mouth is and not just take us for granted simply because they're not Republicans. It's just not good enough.
Sounds very familiar. So can you tell us about your early activism days, how you got started as an activist?
I started becoming politically active as an undergrad in Albany, New York, at the State University there. It was definitely my involvement in defending abortion clinics and Planned Parenthoods. And I was part of a women's rights group that was militant and integrated and took direct action to keep the Planned Parenthood locally open and to also keep Planned Parenthoods open throughout the state when there were national mobilizations. Like this was, I mean, decades ago, you know, this was 1992 when the far right wing and Operation Rescue was trying to affect a national Supreme Court case to try to influence the outcome of that case. And we were able to keep the clinics open in Buffalo, New York, despite a national mobilization by Operation Rescue. We were able to keep the clinics open in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, despite the fact that there were KKK members and neo-Nazis on the lines with Operation Rescue trying to physically assault women going into the clinics and also pro-choice and pro-abortion activists. And between those two successes and then the very militant riots and uprisings that took place in Los Angeles in relationship to the Rodney King decision and the way that that spread across the country and across the globe, the combination of those two things convinced the Supreme Court that it was not a judicious time for them to then take it even further and go after the fundamental rights of 50% of the population. And so that really taught me a serious lesson that with a method of struggle and direct action and independent action that didn't rely on the courts, didn't rely on the politicians or their promises, that we have power ourselves in our own self-organizing. And that's something that I've never forgotten, and I will take that to my grave.
Wow, that's a great early education in activism for sure.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about the event in Sacramento that has put you in the spotlight in recent months, and share with our audience what happened that day?
It was 3 years ago, in June 2016. Donald Trump was running for president, and he had just gotten the Republican Party nomination, or was well on his way to getting it by then. And because he was running on such an openly racist and immigrant-bashing and xenophobic and misogynistic platform, he was definitely raising the confidence of white supremacists and, you know, explicitly self-identified fascists, including in California.
Mm-hmm.
And so a few months before in Santa Ana, the KKK held a recruitment event and rally where they not only were there to rally, as they never are there just to do, but they stabbed a bunch of anti-fascist protesters who had come out. That was shocking, but, you know, I had been part of dozens of anti-fascist protests in the past and had been part of protesting them and shutting down their efforts to attack the community. And I had been part of that for decades before all of this. So leading into Sacramento, we were aware that this had happened in Santa Ana, but, you know, I just never dreamed that that would happen to us in Sacramento on the steps of the Capitol. You know, we were just like, oh, that's Southern California. You know, like that's like the backwater of California, politically, right? Like, and no insult to Southern California people. And so I just did not think, and none of us, really none of us thought that they would do that in Northern California and on the Capitol. But it happened. There were white supremacists, Nazis, who were part of the what are they called? Traditional Workers Party, TWP.
Mm-hmm.
And the Golden State Skinheads, and they came armed. They had knives. They had clubs. They had homemade spears with box cutters taped to the ends of flagpoles that they then thinly tried to disguise with banners or flags on the ends of them. We outnumbered them a lot. You know, there were hundreds of us, and there were very few of them. But what they lacked in number, they came prepared to do violence, and we were not prepared for that. And so it was, I have to say, there's a lot about the day that's really hard to talk about, and a lot that isn't even, you know, is kind of glitchy in my memory.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do remember is the shock and the screams and just a sense that this couldn't actually possibly have just happened. And by the end of the day, there were at least 7 anti-fascists who'd been stabbed, some very seriously. The people who were targeted were disproportionately Black men, Latina and Latino people, Asian protesters, as well as white protesters too, but disproportionately people of color who were clearly targeted by these Nazis. A couple of the men who were stabbed multiple times in their torso or in their lung, like in their side, and required invasive surgery and were in the hospital for weeks. I was one of the people who was stabbed, but my wounds were, relative to some of the other people, were not even nearly as serious as theirs. But I still required, I needed to get 23 stitches in my arm and in my head.
Oh my gosh.
And the police, there were over 100 cops from multiple police, you know, municipalities who were there that day. The other thing I remember was how they stood back and did nothing. They did nothing. They did not lift a finger to protect us or to stop the assault on us. And at the end of the day, nobody was arrested. So not only did these Nazis almost get away with murder, But then over a year later, after Trump was elected and after he was inaugurated, we didn't know it at the time, but the police were given some kind of green light, apparently, to go ahead with a witch hunt. And so over a year later, after everything was over, three of us who were anti-fascists were arrested with false charges of felony. Felony assault is the charge that I'm charged with. And then my two other co-defendants, Mike Williams and Porfirio Paz, are both also charged with felony assault. All three of us are being charged with misdemeanor riot, and I'm being charged with misdemeanor inciting riot because I spoke to the media after everything and made clear that the fascists don't have a right to hide behind free speech when they're trying to kill us, and that it was a victory if we were able to prevent them from attacking anybody in the community, right? Which is clearly what they were setting out and ready to do if they didn't have to go through us first. And that really, to me, is you know, what makes, despite the real and serious casualties of the day, and including the casualties of us fighting this witch hunt since then, you know, made it all worth it, because, you know, I think it would have broken us if the Nazis had been able to break through our counter protest and start running through downtown Sacramento attacking, mm-hmm. you know, unsuspecting families, or, you know, running into the communities or stores like that. I just don't think any of us could have lived with ourselves with that. So we're fighting this. We are absolutely fighting. We've been fighting for 2 years to get these charges dropped. We're still fighting. And if we're not successful in making that happen, then we are prepared to go to trial. And we are ready, mm-hmm. because after El Paso, after Gilroy, after Whitechurch, after the synagogues were attacked in Pennsylvania, I mean, all we've seen since this happened in Sacramento, after Charlottesville, has just been an ascent of these Nazis. And one thing I want to point out is that the DA in Sacramento, Anne-Marie Schubert, is a Trump supporter. She is a Republican who has won in Northern California re-election because she was funded by the Trump base that poured tons of money into getting her to be re-elected. And this is despite the fact that she's hated. She protected the killer cops who murdered Stephon Clark, a young black man who was shot to death by the police, by the Sacramento police, in his own backyard.
Yep.
But she still got reelected because she's a Trump supporter. And in addition, only a few weeks after we were arrested, the same organization that was responsible for us being stabbed, the TWP, then had the confidence and got the funding to hold the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville just a few weeks later. And so there they did murder someone. They killed Heather Heyer. And I will say, and I will always say, that the fact that Schubert arrested three of us and charged anti-fascists, not fascists, but anti-fascists, was a green light to the national fascist movement, that they could not only get away with almost murdering people, but they could get away with murder and have the other side be charged. Yeah. And so I still lay the blame. Certainly she is complicit in that murder, if not directly, then very clearly indirectly. And she cannot and should not be allowed to get away with that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Labor Radio. We have Berkeley teacher and activist Yvette Falarca on the line with us. We only have about 10 minutes left, Yvette. Time is rolling by quickly, as it usually does on this show. So tell us a little bit about some charges and the attention you have received since. There was a formal request for information, and at least including your emails, I don't know, of other communications as well, that that come from your employer, Berkeley School District. Can you tell us about that? Who was requesting that information? What were they looking for? And what information did the school district release?
So a far-right group called Judicial Watch, which has connections to the alt-right, in particular Steve Bannon and Breitbart News. Judicial Watch is based out of Washington, D.C., and they issued a request to the school district for all emails from within my school, so from the staff at my school, as well as from the district administration, that had my name, that had the word BAM, or by any means necessary, or that phrase,
mm-hmm.
That had the word Antifa in it. And it was clearly a political, you know, an attempt to politically target and chill my free speech and the free speech of the teachers in the staff of my school to feel like they couldn't, and to try to discourage us from being politically active for fear that if we are, that our private and personal emails through the school district would be mined and would be subject to be potentially published on right-wing websites, not just by Judicial Watch, but then lifted from there into like 4chan or 8chan, and then be subject to possible, you know, troll armies harassing, threatening, stalking us using the internet. And so I fought this. And me and two other staff members at my school, Larry Steffel and Lori Nixon, filed a lawsuit against the school district to stop them from sharing our emails, and also against Judicial Watch directly for this attempt to try to take away our privacy and our free speech. Our union supported us, both the BFT and also the Classified Workers Union, BCCE.
Okay.
And we had support from the whole staff around this lawsuit. There's no question. Unfortunately, we were not successful in this. The judge in our case, even though he's a Democrat, is a Democrat. I mean, I hate to say it, but and so, no, they're not Republicans, but courage is not the name of a judge or of a politician. And that was definitely true of this judge. And so rather than stand by and protect our free speech and privacy, he instead blamed me for having spoken out publicly against fascism and against the alt-right. He claimed that because I had appeared on Tucker Carlson's show defending stopping Miley Yiannopoulos from terrorizing immigrant and trans members of our community at UC Berkeley and the actions of protesters and that I must have been asking for this, and that I had no basis to demand that my and my staff's emails be kept private. By the end of the day, despite the fact that we weren't able to win, it's certainly made clear to Judicial Watch and to the alt-right that they're not dealing with pushovers or people either in me or in my staff who are easily cowed or scared off, that, you know, I'll use whatever means necessary, whether that's in the streets or whether that's in the courts, to defend myself, my staff, other teachers, and also our community. Because they can't be allowed to just continue this with impunity. And we may not have won it this round, but if they tried to come back again with another request, I promise you, me and other people and my staff would fight them again. This will not be easy for them. Scandalously, the judge ruled that we had to pay them, and that I had to pay them $20,000 in attorney's fees, which is outrageous.
Ouch.
So, yeah. which is sickening. But, you know, I have to say that in hindsight, in all of these things, even knowing that the outcome would be what it is, I still would have taken the same position. I still would take the same actions in the future. It's just too important.
And so that will lead to our very last question. We only have a few minutes left, but what are some lessons that you feel like you've learned that you want to share with other radical activist educators?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, one, you're not alone. And these kinds of attacks, whether it's from our school districts on our contracts or our basic rights as teachers, or whether it's as politically active teachers who are also very committed to social justice outside our classrooms too. There's a lot of us out there, and there's a growing number. There's no question in my mind. And so absolutely reach out. Don't be afraid. Find other people who support and share your views and your convictions and unite together. And you are always invited to join me, to join my caucus, the Eon Bam Caucus, to contact me even just for advice or information or just, you know, about to learn from or hear about, you know, my experiences and decide how that does or doesn't apply to your own. But bottom line, do not bow your head. Don't feel like silence is the only choice that you have or to just be driven out of the profession. Not at all. If anything, there's more and more of us out there who are prepared to take a stand for ourselves, for our coworkers, for our students. And this is the time now because we can't let the bullies win, whether it's the white supremacists, whether it's Trump, or whether it's our abusive administrators. They are bullies because they are small in number. We outnumber them by numbers, and we outnumber them in terms of the size of our hearts and the size of our determination and courage. So,
and brains,
fight
too.
And fight back. And brains, well, of course. Otherwise, we wouldn't be teachers.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This has been a really inspiring interview, and I'm so glad you could join us tonight, Yvette. I'd like to thank our engineer, Selena, and thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Stephen. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Please tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 to catch another Labor Radio show.
Thanks, Yvette.
Thank you.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 8th Annual Portland Latin American Film Festival, taking place at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. The Other Border will screen on September 22nd at 4:45 p.m. The Other Border is the story of high school student Erardo Hernandez, raised in the United States since 6 months of age, who was one of over 100 undocumented workers arrested by ICE in Ohio on June 25, 2018. In attendance will be special guests, including the director and many social justice organizers working on immigration rights and issues. Again, that's The Other Border on Sunday, September 22nd at 4:45 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
Understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening and welcome to Prison Pipeline. This is Emma Lugo, one of the co-hosts of Prison Pipeline, and we are here tonight with Amy Sitars, who worked on the Bronze Shoe Project and has done a lot of work on immigrant detention and immigrant rights. Welcome to Prison Pipeline, Amy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. So tonight we're going to be talking about, you know, a really challenging subject. We're going to be talking some more about what's going on with immigrant rights right now in this country, what's going on with the whole issue of the detention of children and the separation of children from their families of origin. As many of you know, beginning with the recent Trump administration, there's been kind of a ramp up of activities with ICE, with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and we've been building concentration camps on the border of the United States to detain vast warehouses of people who are seeking a better life and are trying to find their way into this country for some hope of economic opportunity. And one of the cruelest things that the current administration has done has they've chosen to, beginning about a year and a half ago, they began to choose to separate children from their families and throw them into various systems, often just putting them in other camps, separated from their families. And this is all part of a policy of the United States government to engage in